the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
Indeed, I'm John Leffler, and Adam Sherry is our guest today. His topic, tax planning, charitable remainder trusts, and other related facts you need to know about for planning retirement. Today on the program, before our guest comes on, we will discuss something very important. There's a report out by the Hamilton Project. You can find it at hamiltonproject.org, 10 economic facts about financial well-being and retirement. We're seeing a number of studies appearing reporting on retirement stresses. Let's face it, if you've listened to the Financial Sense NewsHour, you know that we are in an entirely new normal, a new economic environment that is much different than things we have been in the past. It's not going to change at any time in the near future. Government itself is coming under more and more strain to be able to fulfill its social commitments. At the very same time, its debt load is going up. We've passed $18 trillion. And by the time we change presidential administrations towards 2016, it will be about $20 trillion. The question is, how long can it service its own debt as well as provide all of the things that it has promised to its constituents? And that will affect your retirement.
Well, you know, it's rather interesting because, number one, the baby boom population is probably going to be the largest population in this nation's history to head into retirement. And given the economic environment that is so unusual today, whether you want to call it the new normal, we have spent a lot of time, John, talking about what has happened. And we did this on the show over the weekend where we talked about this rate raising environment is going to be unusual. It's going to be slow. It's going to be shallow. It's going to take a longer period of time. And there have been a number of factors that in this recent study that they said that, you know, for retirement planning, it's becoming a daunting challenge because the financial resources required to support oneself and, let's say, one's spouse in retirement old age are getting to be considerable. And there are many segments of the population that have experienced negligible real wage growth. That's especially characteristic of this economic recovery. And there's so many uncertainties when it comes to, let's say, planning for retirement. We talked over the weekend, the uncertainty over investments. What are you getting on cash? What are you getting on CDs or treasury bills? The traditional safe havens that we used for literally decades in planning for retirement. What about your health? And the one thing that is really impacting retirement, and this is why I think by the end of this decade, we're going to be facing some changes to Social Security, and one of them is going to be extending the retirement age probably to a much higher age. Just as, John, for you and I, they have extended the retirement age to 66 and 67, depending on when you were born, I could see it going to, let's say, age 69. And one of the reasons that the system is coming under difficulty is people are living longer. And now that's both a good thing because we're getting to be healthier and with the advances in medicine, but longevity means that you have to have those assets take care of you over a longer period of time. That's number one. And number two, what the government is paying out in Social Security benefits and Medicare are lasting over a longer period of time as well. So it's not just a strain on you personally, but it's also a strain on government budgets. Since 1989, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid have gone from 13% of government outlays to almost 23%, so almost 10 percentage points of total government spending. The other thing that creates a lot of uncertainty is the type of support available from family members. A lot of boomers have ended up taking care of parents who basically financially couldn't take care of themselves, for example, the cost of long-term care. Something that we saw, let's say, in the 2007-2009 recession, as a lot of people lost their jobs as they were getting near retirement. So let's say that, you know, you're 60 years old, you were thinking you're going to work to age 66, full retirement age, and during the recession, you get laid off 5 or 6 years before you could take full advantage of your retirement benefits. and 5 or 6 years sooner than what you thought or expected to take place when you were planning for your retirement. And you also have the possibility of a serious long-term debilitating illness or the early death of a spouse. Because today, let's say if you worked in the private sector, let's say the husband was the main breadwinner, he could receive his Social Security at full retirement age, and his spouse could receive half of his Social Security benefits. So you would have two Social Security checks or two sources of income. All of a sudden, one spouse passes away. It puts a little bit of a strain on the surviving spouse because you're down to one Social Security check instead of two. There might be, for example, a reduction in pension benefits based on the death of one spouse. That may change. Or when you're choosing a payout, whether it's on an annuity or it's a pension, it may be considerably less if you base it on both spouses. So a lot of these have created a lot of difficult choices and made retirement planning much more complex and more uncertain.
Yeah, it's unfortunate we have to be at this position, but it's more than what you were talking about there, because it's more about the choices that you have to make when you're saving for retirement. You have to balance your day-to-day expenses, the things that you're going to spend on education for your kids, while at the very same time saving. And it's not just a matter of saving, it's a matter of investing for tomorrow, because right now, given where we are in the interest rate environments, you're not going to get anything from saving. So you have to invest. And that involves staying on your toes because things are changing and they will continue to change. The day that we had 40 years ago when you could put your money into a few set areas and let it do its thing are probably over. And that means preparing for retirement, and in retirement, you're going to have to stay on top of this.
You mentioned something. We've done a number of shows on this, especially when it comes to education, because usually, you know, you take a family that's starting out, and we've done this on a number of shows. The earlier that you can start saving, you know, you start at age 25, you probably only need to put away $75 to $150 a month, and you'll have $1 million by the time you get to retirement, because you have a longer period of time for that money to compound. But when most couples are starting out today, they're coming into a marriage with maybe $70,000 to $100,000 of student loan debt. So they're starting off their marriages with a heavy debt burden to begin with. And then you take the early years, you're probably trying to save for a down payment on a house. Then you start a family. All of a sudden you have children. That increases your expenses. So John, it's probably not into your middle 40s, or maybe sometimes in some cases in your 50s, where you're thinking about planning for retirement. At the same time, as a parent, you're probably dealing with choices such as how much money to put aside for junior's education or your daughter's education or daughter and son's education if you have more than one child. And those are very difficult choices. You know, the choices of whether to spend money, take a vacation, go out to dinner. And it involves a lot more choices that you're going to make. And you have to make those choices early on to have a significant impact when it comes to your own retirement. But put it this way, one thing that we're probably going to see going forward is government is going to be stingier when it comes to covering medical expenses and Social Security expenses, because the system would simply go bankrupt. They're going to have to make some changes. People are living longer, which means government is paying out benefits over a longer period of time per individual, both medical benefits, Social Security benefits. They're going to have to extend that age further out as a result of people living longer. So it has gotten to be a lot more complex.
You talked about the various things that have changed, Jim, and the new report discusses 10 facts. Let's see if we can examine these one by one.
Well, in the first chapter of this report, they talk about three major challenges in preparing for retirement. Number one, half of non-retired American adults expect to have enough money to live comfortably in retirement. And this matches a study published earlier based on where investment returns are, where people's, let's say, the amount of assets that have accumulated are much less and less uncertain because we don't have those defined benefit pension plans. The national study, I think that, John, the figure is 53% of adults that are currently working will have a lower standard of living when they reach retirement. And among the adults between ages 18 and 29, the share is 52%. Among those that are non-retired age 50 to 64, according to the latest Gallup poll, it is 45%. And with the boomers, two-thirds are expecting to have a lower lifestyle. So if you look at where this was, and this is only going back roughly about 13 years, the number of non-retired Americans who expected to have enough money to live comfortably in retirement has gone down considerably. It was 59% back in 2002. Now think about what happened back then. Well, first of all, it was our first bear market that we experienced in nearly two decades. And also, interest rates were much, much higher going back to the beginning of the century than where they are today. That figure got down to a low of 38% during the economic downturn in 2012. That's when it reached a bottom. Now, we've had a recovery. The stock market has gone up. Housing prices have gone up. And so that figure has gone up. But still today, 50% of those still working that are non-retired expect to have a lower standard of living when they head into retirement.
All right, there are two more challenges.
Well, in this first chapter, and this is one we have talked about with the doctors we've had on the program, with the advances that we're making in medical science, Americans are living longer. More than three out of five 65-year-olds today will reach the age of 80. And John, that is a considerable increase compared to where we were, let's say, 30 years ago. One in three women versus one in five women who are 65 today. Here's a big one. Think about this, folks. One in five women age 65 today will reach the age of 90. I mean, that is considerable. Now, here's some interesting statistics, and it just talks about where we've gone in, let's say, 1965 versus where we are in 2015. And this deals with longevity. If you look at where we were in 1965, the number of men expected to live to age 70 was 81%. Today, it's 90%. For women, it's gone from 90% to 93%. Now, if we take a look at the number of individuals age 65 that can live to age 80. In 1965, 41% of men were expected to live to age 80. Today, that figure is 62%. For women, it was 62% in 1965. Today, that figure's gone up to 71%. So you've really seen probably the biggest jump in the life expectancy of males. And here's the big one. Those age 65 today that can expect to live to age 90. In 1965, only 10% of men were expected to live to age 90. Today, it's 22%. In 1965, 25% of women had a chance of living to their 90s. Today, that figure is 34%. So one of the problems in retirement is we are living longer. And then the third problem that they found in retirement is around one half of seniors will pay out-of-pocket expenses for long-term care services and support, such as nursing home facilities and home-based health care. And that figure is rising considerably. And, you know, we've talked about the figures here that the number of individuals, because of longevity, this is a bigger problem. I'm dealing with a client right now where their mother had a series of strokes and is now in a long-term care facility, John, at a cost of $6,000 a month because Medicare only covers about 30 days of that kind of expenditure. So obviously, with the longer that we live, long-term care, nursing care, when I give out the figure that if you're a couple today, age 65, between the two of you, you could expect to spend between $230,000 and $260,000 in medical expenses. And that does not cover long-term care. So this is becoming sort of a supplemental issue that is attached to us living longer, which is a good thing. but it's creating problems of outliving assets and also running into long-term care down the road. And so these are probably the three problems in planning for retirement. Then they move on to chapters in terms of how Americans save.
Yeah, and when you look at all of this, Jim, you have to recognize that, as I mentioned when we started this whole segment, the days where you would retire with a pension, maybe it would pay you up to 80% of your original salary after you got vested in the pension, maybe you'd been there for 40 years, whatever the time was. Those days are disappearing very rapidly unless you happen to work for government right now, which of course is also going to be questionable as the government strains to try to keep all of its social commitments. How is it going to do that? Also, we look at the number of bear markets we've been through in various areas. All of these things have radically changed the environment, which leads us to the next items in the report.
Yeah, they talk about in terms of how Americans save for retirement is changing rapidly. And John, you just mentioned probably the most significant one, because in 1978, 2/3 of dedicated retirement assets were held in what we call traditional pension plans. That's where you worked for a company, and based on the years of service and what your salary was, what would happen is when it came to retirement, they'd say, all right, here's what your pension's going to be. You sort of had a good feeling in terms of what that number was going to be. So the first issue is most Americans working in the private sector are no longer covered by pension plans that guarantee a certain level of income. The other thing is middle-class households that are near retirement have bought half of their wealth in their home. And this is significant because in the last financial crisis in 2008, typically in recessions in the past, real estate would hold up. It's just sales would slow down. In this last crisis, housing values dropped by nearly 40%. Well, that becomes significant when half of your net worth is tied up in the value of your home. And then another factor is among households that were near the retirement age, those in the top half of the net worth distribution have more of the assets. In other words, the rich have gotten richer, which is what happens when you're struggling for wage growth. And also, if you have the ability to save and invest, obviously you're going to get wealthier. If you don't have any money to save or invest, then obviously you're not going to be accumulating assets. So this is one thing that we've seen on the upper end.
Yeah, probably the most significant trend that we have seen is the switch from defined benefit plans to something like the 401ks. Remember what we were saying before, that the majority of people have, what, at least half of their net worth invested in their house. And that, of course, lost value during the last recession, etc. So go ahead and take it from there.
Yeah, because the study cited in 1978, 67% of Americans working in the private sector were covered by defined benefit pension plans. And I know, John, when I got started in this business in 1980 as a financial planner, in fact, nobody even knew what financial planning was back then, and I started working in a retirement community in Sun City, Arizona. And the people that were retired really had it pretty good. Most individuals worked in the private sector, so they had pensions, whether they were military pensions or they were private sector pensions. They worked for a major corporation like IBM. They had a pension that gave them maybe probably 70 to 80% of their salary before they retired. Then on top of that, they had Social Security. So between a defined benefit pension plan that covered close to 80%, or between 70 and 80, depending on the number of years at the company, a pension that covered 70 to 80% of your salary, plus on top of that, Social Security, almost 100% of your income in retirement was coming from two guaranteed sources, the company pension plan and Social Security. You add that today, where it's down to roughly about 23%, a significant drop. It dropped down to 32% in 1989, and today it's in the low 20s. And that has probably been the major shift. So if there's a message that's coming through with these studies, and if you're out there saving for retirement, you can expect to provide more of your own retirement benefits. Government is going to be reneging on a lot of its promises. They're going to push back the Social Security age. And folks, it's going to hit the public sector as well, because these government pension plans are not sustainable. You can't have a small minority having lavish pension plans supported by the vast majority of Americans. It's just not going to fly. So the same things that we're seeing in the private sector are also coming to the public sector. So this is something that's why I would encourage you, depending on your age, the sooner you can start putting money aside. I don't care if it's $50, $100, $150, $200, whatever it is that you can afford in the budget, you're going to have to make better savings and investment choices, because you're going to have to rely on more of your own savings and investments to carry you through retirement rather than government promises, which can be changed and reneged on, as we've seen so many times. And we've seen this with Social Security. First, Social Security was tax-free. Then in the 80s, 50% of it was taxable. Then in the 90s, 85% of it became taxable. In the last decade, we saw the retirement ages pushed out further to currently today, where the ages are 66 and 67. You're going to see more changes along those lines in the future, and including in the public sector. What you might see is state workers, teachers, or even government employees, new employees coming into the system will be under a different pension system, because there's no way that the pension system in the public sector is sustainable. It'll collapse of its own weight. Just as we're seeing this problem play out right now on the very same issue in Greece today, if we don't address this in the next decade, we're going to end up being just like Greece.
We mentioned just briefly in passing the idea that during the last downturn, a lot of individuals' wealth was tied up in their homes, which is what you find for the middle class. And of course, when that begins to collapse because of market forces, that represents a real problem.
Well, it does. I mean, in 1989, 44% of an individual's net worth was tied up in their home equity. Today, it's down to 35%, at least according to this study as of 2013. It's probably a little bit better because we had appreciation last year as well. But home net worth is a significant asset. That's why this downturn that we saw in real estate out of the last financial crisis had such severe impacts on a lot of people's retirement in terms of individuals, as we cited in an earlier report, that more boomers intend to work not only in their 60s after they retire, but well into their 70s.
Let's talk about the subject of wealth redistribution, because I know on Financial Sense NewsHour last week we were talking about the idea that governments are going to be more and more stressed to try to fulfill their social commitments. And we do see, you know, we see the wealth distribution, the richer getting richer, the middle class and the poor seem to be having a much harder time dealing with it. And so whenever that happens, you invariably hear politicians begin urging wealth distribution. And it's a hard thing to argue against, especially when people are hurting.
Well, it is. But what it does, it destroys economic incentive. You get lower economic growth. And the main reason that you see a lot of this inequality is created by central bank policies and monetary stimulus. I mean, if you're a saver, if you're a middle-class person, and back in the year 2000, you could have got 5, 6, 7% on your savings. Today, you're getting zero. And the other thing that we're seeing as a result of, you take a look at government taxes. You take a look at an average middle-class couple today. They work, 7.65% comes right off the top in Social Security taxes. You can double that to 15.3% right off the top with no deduction if you're self-employed. So automatically, anywhere from, let's say, over 7.5% to almost 15% right off the top of your paycheck. Then you add in federal taxes for most middle-class families. They're anywhere from a 25 to a 31% tax bracket for federal taxes. Then on top of that, you add state taxes. Let's say you make $100,000 as a married couple today. That does not put you in Beverly Hills or in the Hamptons on $100,000. I mean, you're barely scraping by. And $100,000 in California, you'd be lucky if you could qualify for a home. So not only is the government taking a greater portion of your earned income, but they're also taxing you everywhere you look. You're paying gas taxes, sales taxes. Take a look at your cable bill and your phone bill. Take a look at all the little taxes you're getting nicked on. So taxes and inflation with the debasement of the currency is what is hurting the middle class today. It's government policy. Because if we didn't have inflation, if we didn't have the Fed messing around with interest rates. I mean, John, you think about back in your days when you were growing up, what did it take? It took one income for one spouse to support a family. My dad supported 10 kids. My mom stayed at home. I imagine it was the same in your family.
As a matter of fact, it was. But we began to see that change then as our generation grew up. They had to do more and more. Well, why is that? Well, we began chasing the inflation curve on up.
Yeah. And as a result of the U.S. going off gold backing of the currency, the government was able to debase the currency, create inflation, manipulate interest rates, deficit spend, and create this enormous debt load. And what happened as a result in the 70s, mom had to go to work to maintain the family income. I suppose at the rate that we're going with these government policies, with taxes and inflation, the kids are going to have to go to work to support the family, and who knows, maybe the family dog.
Right. Those were the first seven policies in the Hamilton Project survey report. Three more to go here. Now, anything significantly different?
One, and this is something I think ought to be corrected in the education system, is basic financial concepts are not well understood by many Americans. That was one of them. You know, whether it's bond duration, whether it's compounding of interest, or even the investment choices, it's amazing. This is something that has fascinated me in my investment career, is you will see individuals spend about 5 minutes on financial topics, very little time on whether it's planning or having a plan for retirement, having a plan for education, a plan for their family, very little time, and yet they'll spend hours shopping online trying to find the best prices. And so one of the things that they found is basic financial concepts are not well understood by many of Americans. It's financial illiteracy. Around half of Americans under retirement age are now starting to turn to financial advisors for help. But one of the problems that we have in the field is getting unbiased help from high qualified individuals versus those, let's say, individuals that work on a commission basis that may be skewed more towards a financial product rather than what is called the well-being of the individual. So financial literacy is a major issue. I mean, just even the things that we've talked about on the program here about how to prioritize education expenses, retirement expenses, this is a major issue. And this, I just want to warn people on this. There are going to be changes to entitlements by the time we get to the end of this decade. The OMB has said that the budgets begin to accelerate after 2016, and we know that will happen with Obamacare, and also the dynamics of taxation. And it was like almost 30 workers supporting every one person retired on Social Security back in 1933. By the time we got to the 1960s, it was 9 workers paying into Social Security for every one worker retired. Today, it's 4.3 workers paying into Social Security for every one person retired. So mathematically, you add two factors. Number one, people are living longer. That means Social Security is going to get paid out over a longer period of time. Number two, there's less people paying into Social Security, and the number of workers supporting it, paying into it, versus those receiving it. And Social Security, contrary to the lies told by government and the media, it's a pay-as-you-go system. There is no real trust fund. That money has been spent, and IOUs have been put there instead of you putting money like you do in a 401k program. They don't have a bond portfolio, a stock portfolio, a real estate portfolio like, let's say, CalPERS does to support state workers here in the state of California or teachers. So there's less people supporting the system and people living longer. The combination of the two of those alone makes it more difficult to support this system. And that's why you're going to see more changes. And then the final point that they came in the study is federal tax breaks to incentivize retirement add up to be, this is what the government calls tax expenditures, are about $100 billion a year. That's what individuals save by contributing to pension plans, you know, whether it's a 403, 401, K plan, a defined benefit pension plan, you get a tax break. So if you put $10,000 into your 401k program this year, that's $10,000 you didn't pay any federal income taxes on. So the government is incentivizing you to save for your retirement. But it was rather interesting, John, if you take a look at these 10 facts, and I imagine we're going to see more and more of this, and this is going to become a hotter topic of debate in the presidential election, because in 2017, the full cost of Obamacare is going to hit individuals. And contrary to the lies told by the White House, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your plan, and the cost of medical insurance is going down, it's balderdash. I don't need to tell you, if you're in the private sector, you're seeing more corporations today have employees contribute more towards their medical plans because the cost increases have been high single digits. They accelerated with the passage of Obamacare. That goes into effect in 2017. By 2017 into, I think of the figures, 2025, the amount of individuals that will be in retirement receiving Medicare and Social Security begin to escalate. And so the fact that we have fewer workers and people are living longer are going to mean that they are going to have to modify this and change this in the years to come, which means it's going to be incumbent upon you to do more and more of your own planning if you want to have a prosperous retirement.
And coming up next, Adam Sherry on tax planning, charitable remainder trusts, and other items of interest in planning for retirement as lifetime income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, one good news that we saw with the Tax Recovery Act back in 2012, we had estate taxes and the exemption clarified. Currently, the exemption is roughly about $5,350,000. It goes up by the inflation rate. Tax rates on estates are at 40%. But there's another aspect to giving today, and that is charitable giving, and that's what we're going to be talking about on today's program. Because just as you can give money away, you can give $14,000 a year, but what about when you have a highly appreciated asset? What are some of the best strategies that can minimize taxes, reduce them, in fact, get you tax benefits, and benefit you long term? Joining me on the program is Adam Sherry. He's from the law firm Anderson & Yoakum. And Adam, you know, one thing that we have with the Tax Recovery Act of 2012, they clarified tax rates for most individuals in this country. You're still under the Bush tax rates until you get into the higher income levels, $400,000, $450,000 if you're married. But people often forget that there's another tax that's still in place. That's the capital gains tax. And depending on what income bracket you fall into, that could be either 15%, 20%, then you add, or it could be 23.8% if you add the Obamacare tax. And if it's real estate, it could be 28%, or let's say tangibles such as precious metals. So I want to talk about some strategies that can minimize the income tax consequences, because we also have to throw in, if you live in a state like California, over 13% income tax rates. Let's talk about charitable trust, and there's various forms. There's the lead trust, the remainder trust. So let's talk about why somebody would want to consider this, and especially if they have a very highly appreciated asset.
I'm happy to talk about this, because this is one of those opportunities where a certain amount of advanced planning on an individual's part can really achieve a variety of very worthwhile goals. So as you mentioned, you can support a cause or a charitable organization that you really believe in, that does good work. And as you mentioned, you can also avoid income tax on some of your assets. You can avoid capital gains tax. You can reduce or eliminate your estate tax. And so when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, you really have the option to allocate this money to an organization or a cause that you believe in, or you could pay it in tax. And so you, me, and I'm sure all of your listeners would prefer to have a little bit more input and some say when it comes to where that money goes. And so as you've identified, there's several different ways that we can go about doing this.
You know, one thing that, and let's just take an example, we'll get into some specifics, but let's say that I had the good fortune to buy Apple stock when it was at $14 a share. Let's just make this easy for illustration for our listeners. Let's say I put $100,000 into Apple stock. Today, Apple stock is worth $1 million. So I have capital gains of, let's say, $900,000. Now, if I sell that in California, and let's say I'm a high tax bracket investor, I could pay up to, let's say, 23.8% federal tax and 13% state of California tax. So, Adam, you're looking at almost 37-38%. So let's say under these circumstances, I decide that I have charities I would like to give to, or something I'd like to do on the back end because I may have estate tax problems. I decide to transfer that $1 million of Apple stock to a charitable remainder trust. Let's talk about how that works, what the tax benefits are, and then we can even talk about what some of the income benefits are going to be to the beneficiary. So take our listeners through the step of transferring that stock and setting up a charitable remainder trust. How does this work?
So first things first, and you hit it right on the head, is you need to identify the asset that you're going to use to fund this particular trust. And that's really a very important step because, as you've identified, there are certain assets that are well suited to fund a trust like this. And there are other assets where you don't necessarily achieve as large of a gain. So touching base with your financial advisor to help identify those assets is definitely a first step. After that, it's kind of a matter of deciding what you want. Now, thankfully, the IRS wants to encourage charitable giving. That's something that they believe in. So we have a variety of different options when it comes to that. So generally speaking, there's charitable lead trusts, and then there's charitable remainder trusts. And these trusts can either be established during life or established at the end of a person's life as a testamentary trust. So a charitable lead trust is a trust that you set up, you fund it with these highly appreciated assets, and a amount is donated to the charity or organization of your choosing for a fixed period of time. And then after that fixed period of time ends, the remainder is left either to you or a person or persons that you donate, such as your family. Now, a charitable remainder trust is just like the opposite of a charitable lead trust, in that you set in a period of time. It could be a person's lifetime. It doesn't have to be your lifetime. It could be a different person's lifetime, or it could be a term of years up to 20 years. And during those years, you receive either a fixed amount or a fixed percentage of the total value of the assets in the trust. And then at the end of that period, whatever remains is then transferred to the organization or charitable entity of your choosing.
Let's take each trust. First of all, if I was thinking of setting up a charitable trust, explain for our listeners when I might want to use a lead trust versus a remainder trust. Let's talk about what kind of strategies or what kind of goals and objectives would distinguish between using either one.
Great question. One of the benefits of a lead trust, you know, one of the first things you need to think about is, do I need access to these funds now? And an additional question that you should be asking is, are these assets that produce a high amount of income, or are they something like, you know, an appreciated asset which has a large degree of appreciation but doesn't necessarily produce much income? So if it's an asset that you don't have an immediate need of, so you don't need to be receiving that income, you don't need access to the appreciated asset, then a lead trust is a good approach because it's during that set period that the contributions to the charitable organization are made. And then, you know, you are alive during that time. You have the ability to enjoy the knowledge that those donations are being made. You know, it could be a good time to form a closer relationship with the particular entity. But it needs to be an asset or an income stream that you don't need immediate access to. Now, if there was an asset or an income stream that you wanted to retain access to in the present, but you weren't so much worried about it down the line, let's say after a fixed term of 20 years or after you pass away, then it may be a better use to go with a remainder trust so that you retain access to either the income stream or the appreciated asset during your life or during that fixed term. And then it's after you pass away or even after your spouse passes away, because, you know, it doesn't have to end with your life. You can add a second person as a measuring life. And then so it's after the two of you are done using it or you and a family member are done needing access to it, that it's able to make that contribution to the cause or the charitable organization of your choosing.
Let's talk about the tax deductions when you set up either trust, whether it's a lead or a remainder trust. Explain the difference of the tax consequences. Number one, I would assume in both cases, Adam, that if, let's say, we take that Apple stock example that we began this discussion with, if I have $1 million of Apple stock with $900,000 of capital gains, I can forego the capital gains taxes if I sell that stock within the trust. I think that would be one. And then what about the tax deductions of making the donation itself, the $1 million of assets? Can you distinguish between the tax deductions up front and also the capital gains taxes, whether I'm setting up a lead trust or a remainder trust?
As you identified, the capital gains tax advantages are just great here. And so you experience a similar benefit, whether it's a lead trust or a remainder trust, because once you contribute those assets to these trusts, which, you know, they're irrevocable trusts. So this is something that you need to put some real thought into, make sure that you meet with your financial advisor, that you consult somebody who has tax knowledge, an estate planning attorney, because that's a good point, right? They're irrevocable trusts. However, that leads to the benefit that we've been talking about, because as soon as you contribute those appreciated assets to those trusts, they're not going anywhere. So the IRS is satisfied that there is a charitable organization that is going to benefit from that. So whether you're contributing an appreciated asset to a lead trust or to a remainder trust, you are able to benefit from that savings when it comes to capital gains tax. Now, one of the additional benefits is a potential reduction in your taxable estate. And so we're going to talk about charitable foundations later, or, you know, outright charitable donations to something like a community foundation. And we're going to talk about the implications for estate tax there. And they're a little more clear cut. However, when dealing with charitable trusts, the total amount by which your taxable estate is going to be reduced is equal to the amount which the IRS estimates will ultimately be transferred to the charitable organization. So while you may be contributing $1 million of Apple stock to the trust, you can't assume that that is going to be eligible for a charitable deduction of your total taxable estate equal to $1 million. Instead, it's going to have to be run through an IRS equation in which, based on the characteristics of the trust that you've established, they're able to say, you know, this is going to be a great gift to a charitable organization. We know that approximately X is going to ultimately pass to that organization. Therefore, X can be taken away from a person's taxable estate. So for your listeners out there who are in that range where they know they have a taxable estate, where, you know, it's over the exemption amount, the actual amount that's going to be reduced is something that you should check in with your tax advisor, your financial advisor, and your estate planning attorney beforehand, and they'll be able to actually run that calculation for you and give you a good idea. And, you know, that's, I suppose, a long way of explaining the fact that just because we're donating that $1 million of Apple stock doesn't mean that we can reduce our taxable estate by $1 million when it comes to the estate tax.
Let's talk about the tax deduction. In this case, let's just talk about a charitable remainder trust. Same example, I donate $1 million of Apple stock. And let's just take, for example, IRS rules and just say that the life expectancy, and for our listeners, when you donate the $1 million to the charitable remainder trust, you're going to have use of the income the trust produces. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But you have use of the assets, but once again, the charity is not going to get those assets until, let's say, you and your spouse pass on or you yourself. So let's say that you have a life expectancy under IRS tables of 10 years. Let's say you're 75, your life expectancy is 85. let's talk about, in addition to avoiding the capital gains taxes, also the income tax deduction that you get from making that charitable gift. It's $1 million, but once again, the charity doesn't get it for 10 years, so you're not going to get $1 million deduction up front.
No, you're not going to get $1 million deduction up front. So based on that IRS table that you referred to, and you know these really are kind of convoluted tables when you end up looking at it, but a calculation is going to be performed whereby they take your present age, you know, and as you mentioned, your life expectancy, and they're going to apply that calculation to the amount that you're contributing to the trust. They'll reduce it by the amount that you're taking back from the trust, because we haven't really touched on the fact yet, but based on your needs, you could set it up so that you take 5% back annually, or you could take 7% back annually, you could take 10% back annually. You know, there's a lot of moving parts here, and while that may be confusing to a certain degree, the positive side of that is that it makes it that much easier for you to find something that suits your personal situation. So after running your life expectancy, the amount that you're going to be receiving back, and the total contribution to the charitable trust, you know, they're going to be able to come back to you with a number, and they're going to say, you're going to end up donating approximately 1/3 of the total value to the charitable organization. So therefore, we're going to give you that dollar amount as a reduction in your total taxable estate at the point that you pass away.
And to illustrate this, let's say you donate $1 million, you're age 75, your life expectancy is, let's say, 10 years. What they essentially do is they take a present value calculation and say, what's that $1 million worth 10 years from now when the charity gets it? So let's say the present value of that is $250,000. So Adam, in addition to avoiding the capital gains tax on the $1 million, let's say that could be over $300,000, you're also going to get a $250,000 charitable deduction, which you can use to offset your taxable income in the year you make the donation, and any unused portion you can carry forward. So there's really a double benefit here. There's a huge tax deduction you get in the year that you make the gift, and depending on the size, you could carry that forward, but also the benefit of avoiding the capital gains taxes. So there's really two tax benefits here.
I couldn't have said it better. And, you know, that's largely a product of A, choosing the right assets to contribute, and B, picking the right type of trust. So yeah, exactly. You hit it right on the head. There is a real double benefit there. And there's the intangible benefit as well, which knowing that however much is ultimately transferred to the charitable organization is an organization that you chose, that you believe in, that you know does good work. And so, I mean, it's really a great opportunity.
Yeah, because actually you can throw in a third tax deduction savings if you're in a state large enough where you're going to be subject to estate taxes. So you get an income tax deduction up front. You avoid the capital gains tax on the sale of the asset, and you also save on estate taxes, which are as high as 40%. So it's a win-win. All three, if you look at the three tax benefits, which really benefits estates of substantial assets. Let's also talk about, you still can get income, because you and I worked on a case, and this was a case a number of years ago where a gentleman, I worked with him, he had a company, he sold his company to a public company. In exchange, he got stock in a public company. Now, there was no taxable event for the exchange of one corporate stock for another, but he was going to head into retirement after he sold his company. So he was interested in income, but did not want to give away, I think the combined tax rates back then were about 35%. He didn't want to give away a third of the assets, because almost the entire gain of the sale of the company was all capital gains, because he had started his company a long time ago. So there weren't really a lot of cost basis left in the company. We were able to transfer that stock to a charitable remainder trust. And at that time, and of course, this was in 1999, we took a 6% distribution rate, which meant, for sake of illustration, let's just say it was $1 million. It was substantially more than that. He would then get $60,000 annually, or 6% of the value of the principal. In addition to that, as the principal rose as a result of gains in the stock market and investment management, that 6% applies to a higher value. So in this case, the assets in the charitable trust more than doubled, which meant that the income to the client, now his widow, also doubled. So let's talk about some of the income benefits too, because even though the trust is irrevocable, you transfer the assets to the trust, but you still have a right to income and how it's managed, and you don't lose that control. Address that issue.
That's a great point. And, you know, this is a really good example just because it's another one of your great success stories here, because that remaining family member, his widow, continues to benefit from this trust on a monthly basis. And so you highlight a great point in that once the asset is contributed, once we get it into the irrevocable trust, it's not a matter of going totally hands-off on that asset. It's not as if you had to hand it over to the IRS or to a government body or something like that and rely on them to manage it. No, instead, you can continue to receive the advice of your financial advisor. You can continue to be involved in making those assets truly productive. And when you're set to receive a percentage of the total value of the underlying assets, you have a real potential to increase that amount if you're able to wisely invest those assets, make them more productive, and increase the value of the underlying assets. So, you know, I appreciate that you pointed that out, because even though these trusts are irrevocable, it doesn't mean that your involvement with those assets ends or that you're no longer allowed to apply your industry to make sure that those assets are still productive. And the encouraging part about that is that you're really rewarded for making those underlying assets more productive when it's a fixed percentage that you're getting back.
Yeah, in this particular case, the way it worked out, and this will just give our listeners an example, as my client sold his company, we transferred the public stock to the charitable remainder trust. It was a substantial sum of money. We saved about 35%, more than a third, in capital gains taxes. That was the first thing. The second thing, because of the age of the clients, the calculation on the income tax deduction, we used the tax savings for the charitable deduction to wind down his IRA. So as he pulled money out of his IRA, we were offsetting part of the IRA ordinary income with a charitable tax deduction. And today we're working with his widow. This is 15 years later, even despite the fact that she's made substantial gifts after the passing of her husband to one of the particular charities. There were three charities in this case that were named in the remainder trust. Even after substantial gifts made to charity, her income is 2.5 times larger today as a result of the trust appreciating in assets than it was in the year 2000. So, Adam, if we were to sum up the benefits of a charitable trust, I would say they're fourfold. Correct me if I'm wrong in this. You can get a substantial income tax deduction upfront, depending on your age, because that determines the present value calculation when the charity gets it. So you get a income tax deduction upfront. You avoid the capital gains tax, so there's a second tax savings. Three, if your estate is large enough, you save on, let's say, estate taxes. And number four, you still have control over the income off the assets, which could be much larger since, number one, you're avoiding over a third in capital gains taxes. Have I missed anything here?
That's exactly it. And this illustration is so great of when the circumstances are right, these can be very, very powerful instruments.
Now, let's talk about another form of charitable giving. And you see this whether you're watching NPR or National Public Television. You see some of these programs. They're sponsored by these various foundations. What's the difference between, let's say, a charitable remainder trust, whether it's a lead or a remainder trust or a foundation? Is it really a situation where you have to have substantially more assets to make it really worthwhile? I mean, if I was taking individual, let's call him Larry Lots of Bucks, let's say he has charitable leanings, he has a capital gains problem, he has an income tax problem, he has an estate tax problem. What is the difference between setting up a foundation or setting up a charitable trust?
That's a great question. And you know what? I feel like Larry Lots of Bucks is well suited for something like a charitable foundation, while you know, your client that we worked with was very well suited for something like a charitable remainder trust. So as we've discussed, one of the benefits of the charitable remainder trust was that the client was able to continue receiving an income stream from these assets even after it was contributed to the irrevocable trust. However, one of the things that we noticed was that the reduction in their taxable estate did not necessarily equal the total value of the assets that were contributed to the charitable remainder trust. Now, Mr. Lassabucks likely is in a situation where he does not need to retain access to those particular assets to support his lifestyle. Instead, he and his family are more concerned about the implications of the estate tax at the end of their life or at the time in which they would like to start transferring assets to the next generation. And so a charitable foundation, you know, in a case like this, can be more useful in that it's more effective at reducing the total taxable estate. There's pretty much an unlimited charitable deduction when the assets move directly out of a person's estate, and they're moved out of a person's estate, they're dedicated to a charitable purpose, and the donor no longer has access to those funds for their personal benefit. And so when somebody's able to take, you know, that larger chunk of money that they no longer need access to, but they're philanthropically inclined, you know, they're more interested in seeing these appreciated assets, they're more interested in seeing them go to support a cause that they believe in, you know, than paying these very high tax rates that you've identified on appreciated assets. By contributing them to a charitable foundation, they're able to allocate all those resources, all those benefits to a cause that they believe in, and that they're able to get really a dollar for dollar reduction in their taxable estate.
So in this case, really, I would assume, Adam, when you take an individual who is obviously beyond the estate tax exemption, let's take somebody that's worth 30, 40, 50 million, at least this is where I've seen foundations come into play, where there's more than ample assets that the couple or individual has to live on. In this case, rather than see those assets go to the government, where the government's going to take 40% or nearly half of the assets, and even more if there's like pension funds, because there's income taxes as well, this individual chooses instead to set up a foundation. Let's talk about also with these foundations. You've seen it with the Rockefellers. You've seen it with the Carnegie Foundations and the Ford Foundations, that family members can serve on the board and receive a salary and be a director of the foundation. They just can't be controlling directors.
You highlighted a great point here. So there's public benefits, and then there's also a certain private benefit. So the public benefit is all the good that these foundations have done. You know, I don't think any of your listeners could listen to that list of foundations without being able to identify one major public work that they've contributed to the larger society. So, you know, one of the real positive public elements there is being able to support that cause that you believe in, to give back to your community, and to create a real legacy. You know, like I know that San Diego, where we both live, has some really excellent public spaces that are a legacy of particular persons through their foundation. And so that's one of the really positive public benefits of it. Now, you know, we also mentioned kind of the private aspects of it. And so family members can be involved in the board. They can be actively engaged in reviewing proposals for certain grants and funding. And, you know, with some of the people that I've worked with, they really describe that as one of the best things about it, whether it be established during their lifetime, and it's one of the ways that they really like to spend their time. It's something that they enjoy engaging in with their spouse and their family. And then, you know, these same people also are able to look forward and know that it's a really positive activity that their children will be engaged in. We've both worked with these particular clients, and they have a family foundation, and it's one of the big ways that their siblings all get together every year when they have to meet together for their board meeting, go over the proposals, and it really creates a lasting bond for that family when they can come together knowing that they're doing good And so it's one of those really interesting double benefits of establishing something like that.
Once again, as we sum up some of the benefits of doing this, there are really three or four benefits here. One, we talked about the income tax deduction that you get, you can use to offset ordinary income. Secondly, the avoidance of capital gains, which could be, you know, in the state of California, the combination of federal and state could be as high as 37%. The avoidance of estate taxes, which could be 40%. The ability to control the income and have experience increasing income as those assets appreciate. It's one reason why, Adam, you see so many of these wealthy families set up these foundations, because it's really a win-win situation tax-wise, and the government encourages this.
There's no doubt. I mean, there's absolutely an element of altruism involved in all of these transactions and these decisions to establish these trusts and foundations. But there's also just an undeniable aspect of it, that it is a prudent use of your assets and your resources. I mean, it's a wonderful way to apply the assets and the wealth that you've been given with, that you've accumulated and earned, in really the most efficient and most effective way possible, and to kind of avoid some of the waste that's often associated with excessive taxation.
Well, listen, Adam, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income this week as we discuss some of the possibilities of charitable gifting could be used with tremendous tax benefits. If our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do in this area, how could they do so, please?
Checking out our website is a great place. The website is Anderson Yoakum. That's Anderson, YOCUM.com. It's a good opportunity to reach out, get in touch, or see exactly what it is that we do.
Adam, well, listen, all the best to you, and thanks for coming back and speaking with us on this very important topic.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Once again, if you are fortunate enough to be one of those individuals that have highly appreciated assets, whether it's a family company, it's real estate, or it's a stock investment, and you are in a high income tax bracket, a high estate tax bracket, really do yourself a favor. There are so many advantages to exploring the tax benefits of charitable gifting. The government endorses this. Like we mentioned in the program there, there's income tax deductions up front. There's the avoidance of capital gains taxes, which means if you sell the asset, you have more assets to work for you, and you don't give up any of the control if you invest in something else within the trust and appreciates, and also the estate tax benefits. But there's so many benefits out there to using charitable gifting strategies if you're fortunate enough to be in that kind of situation. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.